rallies in Bahrain, where public anger is building up ahead of a visit by the Israeli president. Canada unleashes new sanctions targeting several Iranian entities and individuals. And in South Korea, thousands of workers show their solidarity with the truck drivers on strike. Our top story. People in Bahrain have taken to the streets in protest at the upcoming trip by Israeli President Isaac Herzog to their country. The protesters gathered in several areas of Bahrain on Friday, chanting death to Israel. They also carried signs with Herzog's image, calling him a criminal. Opposition activists launched a campaign as well on social media, speaking out against normalization with Israel. Herzog is set to arrive in Bahrain on Sunday. He will be the first Israeli president to visit the Arab country. Bahrain, along with the UAE and Morocco, normalized ties with the regime in 2020 under a US-backed deal. The move sparked Muslims' anger, who called it a betrayal to the Palestinian cause. This as Israeli forces kill a Palestinian man in the West Bank in the most recent case of such deadly violence in the occupied territories. The Palestinian man was shot dead following an alleged stabbing attack against the regime's forces at a checkpoint in Nablus. Footage released on social media shows the Palestinian man shot four times at point blank range as he was lying on the ground. The Palestinian Red Crescent says Israeli forces blocked emergency responders from reaching the victim. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has vowed revenge, saying the killing shows the fascist nature of the Israeli occupying regime. Hamas also says that this crime should prompt all international human rights organizations to hold the Israeli regime accountable. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil. She explains how the Palestinian paramedics were not allowed to help the Palestinian victim, as well as the false account that Israel presented about the incident.
According to eyewitnesses, this Palestinian man was left bleeding for 15 minutes. Palestinian paramedics were not allowed to take him, and neither the Palestinian ambulances, until Israeli ambulance and more Israeli soldiers came to the area after almost 15 minutes, and they took him. It was, according to eyewitnesses, this Palestinian man, or the body of this Palestinian man, was wrapped in plastic bags, and this is a sign that he was dead. And he was taken by the Israeli soldiers. The identity of this Palestinian man was revealed as a Palestinian from the village of Osarin in Nablus. The real story, it's not clear. Israeli media claims that Israeli soldiers opened fire at a Palestinian who tried to stab Israeli soldiers. But according to the video, it was showing an Israeli soldier trying to arrest an unarmed Palestinian man, and then, without causing him any harm, of course, to the Israeli soldier, he opened fire and shot him in front of the people there.
The UN General Assembly has passed a resolution acknowledging Nakba. That's an Arabic term meaning catastrophe, and used by Palestinians to refer to the day when Israel was created in 1948. Every year on Nakba Day, people take to the streets to decry the expulsion of Palestinians from their homelands and Israel's continued atrocities. The UN General Assembly will next year commemorate the 75th anniversary of the Palestinian Nakba Day with a high-level event.
The UN General Assembly has voted in favor of a pro-Palestinian resolution to commemorate the Nakba, or Catastrophe Day, which marks the Israeli regime's claiming existence in 1948. The Assembly adopted the resolution with 90 votes in favor, 30 negative votes, and 47 abstentions. The initiative was sponsored by Egypt, Jordan, Senegal, Tunisia, Yemen, and the Palestinians, and was approved despite the opposition of the US, UK, and Israel, and most European Union countries. 47 states abstained. The UN resolution calls for a, quote, commemoration of the 75th anniversary of the Nakba, including by organizing a high-level event at the General Assembly Hall in May 2023. The resolution also urges the dissemination of relevant archives and testimonies. Nakba Day, or Day of Catastrophe, falls on May 15 of each year. The date commemorates events that led to the Israeli regime forcibly expelling hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their homes in order to make way for the Israeli settlers 74 years ago.
Regrettably today, in the absence of a just solution, 75 years since the General Assembly's decision to partition historic Palestine with the adoption of Resolution 181 Roman II and the prolongation of Israel's occupation, now for over 55 years, the Palestinian people, including the Palestine refugees, continues to experience increasing levels of dispossession, displacement, violence, human rights violations, and insecurity.
The General Assembly also adopted other resolutions on the question of Palestine. They called for an immediate halt to settlement activities, land confiscation and home demolitions, the release of prisoners, and an end to arbitrary detentions.
The ongoing expansion of by Israel by the occupying power of illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem, and the attendant settler violence, which is also on the rise, need decisive action. These illegal actions constitute grave breaches of international law and are a flagrant obstruction of the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination.
The anti-Israel resolutions come amid increasing violence by the regime against Palestinians. This year alone, Israeli regime forces have killed scores of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the besieged the Gaza Strip. Palestinian resistance movements have warned that Israel will, quote, pay dearly for the killings.
Separately, the UN General Assembly adopted a resolution regarding the Syrian Golan Heights, which the Israeli regime has been occupying for more than half a century. The resolution has demanded the withdrawal of the regime from that area. It called on Israel to implement the resolutions of the Security Council and to withdraw from the Golan to the line of June 4, 1967. On Thursday, Israeli forces killed two Palestinians during a raid near the city of Jenin in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. Before raiding Jenin, Israeli forces attacked the town of Yabad, southwest of Jenin, and killed a 22-year-old man there. This is not an isolated act of violence against Palestinians. Israeli occupation forces have ramped up military activity in the West Bank, killing more Palestinians during the past months. Since the start of 2022, Israeli troops have killed more than 200 Palestinians, including more than 50 children in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds, as well as the besieged Gaza Strip. That is the highest record of killings since the year 2006.
In 2022, we have witnessed a dangerous escalation in Israeli military raids across the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem, leading to the killing and injury of more civilians, including women and children.
And none of the soldiers have been investigated to any of the crimes. This is a clear indication how the policy of the coming Israeli cabinet will be: more killings and more aggression.
Israeli officials have described the security situation in the occupied West Bank as dangerous. They've even suggested that the regime could face another intifada or uprising. Palestinians have vowed to respond against Israel's acts of aggression. On November 23, two separate explosions rocked two bus stations at the entrance of occupied Al-Quds. The blasts were in response to a long period of ongoing Israeli oppression of the Palestinian people. The tensions come as Israel is about to have one of the most extreme right-wing cabinets in the coming weeks. The cabinet, which is headed by Benjamin Netanyahu, is controversial due to the controversial Israeli politicians who've been mired in corruption and controversies.
Turning elsewhere, Canada has announced additional sanctions against Iran. over what it describes as human rights violations as well as actions threatening international peace. The new measures target four individuals over their involvement in the Iranian government's response to the recent unrest there. Five entities are targeted too. They include two Iranian technology firms accused of cooperating with the government in transferring drones to Russia for use in the Ukraine war. Canada and its Western allies allege that Russia has used the Iranian drones against civilians in Ukraine. Iran has strongly denied that. It says it gave the aircraft to Russia prior to the Ukraine war and as part of mutual defense cooperation. Iran also denies human rights violations against its people. The country in November put sanctions on a Canadian entity and eight individuals in a reciprocal move. South Korean workers have rallied in the capital Seoul in support of the ongoing strike by truckers. The protesters, including truckers, were workers from South Korea's biggest labor union. It said about 5,000 workers joined the rally, taking place near the National Assembly. Saturday marks the 10th day of a nationwide strike by Korean truckers. More than 20,000 have stopped working to demand better pay. The government has ordered them to get back on the road because the action has disrupted the supply chain. It has also said it would not expand a minimum pay system for truckers beyond a further 3 years. The unions have rejected that. Now, members of the European Union have agreed to place a price cap on Russian oil in an attempt to limit Moscow's ability to finance its war in Ukraine. The price cap is set at $60 a barrel and includes a mechanism to keep Russian oil at 5% below the market price. The decision will come into effect this weekend. EU nations have also agreed to push forward with a new round of sanctions against Russia. The EU has also imposed a ban on seaborne imports of Russian oil, which comes into effect on Monday. Russia has warned that it will not export oil to countries that respect the price cap. And Russia accuses Western countries of pursuing, quote, destructive policies by pumping Kiev with weapons and training the Ukrainian military. The Russian president says political and financial support from Ukraine's Western allies has led to Kiev completely rejecting any form of negotiations. Vladimir Putin made the remarks during a phone conversation with the German chancellor. During the conversation, Olaf Scholz urged Putin to find a diplomatic solution to end the war, including pulling out Russian troops from Ukraine. Russia has said that it's open to talks with the US on resolving the conflict in Ukraine, but the Kremlin says efforts to find a possible compromise are being hampered by the US. It has cited Washington's refusal to recognize the four Ukrainian regions Russia annexed in September. The Italian parliament has passed a resolution authorizing the government to continue to help Ukraine, including via military aid, throughout 2023. This as an increasing number of Italians are advocating for peace negotiations to end the Russia-Ukraine conflict.
The Italian government has been authorized to send, when it sees fit, military assets, materials and equipment to Ukraine until December 31st next year. The go-ahead has arrived from Italy's lower house, the Chamber of Deputies, which has passed a motion presented by the right-leaning parties backing the government coalition and supported by some opposition groups, including centre-left Democratic Party and centrist Italia Viva Azione. Italy has so far classified the arms it has been sending to Ukraine, but some media have suggested the next package will likely include air and missile defence.
9 months after the start of the conflict, sending weapons to Ukraine is no longer the way to go. We must put peace talks on the table and work all together for a UN-backed peace conference promoted by the EU.
Support for Ukraine has been a contentious issue within the ruling coalition, with Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni positioning herself as a staunch supporter of Kiev. However, her partners Matteo Salvini and Silvio Berlusconi, respectively leaders of the League and Forza Italia parties, have been so far much more ambiguous due to their historical ties with Moscow and President Vladimir Putin. The two have repeatedly stressed the urgency of stepping up efforts to promote peace negotiations.
Giorgia Meloni is firmly and strongly linked or attached to the partnership and the alliance in with the United States and with NATO. So I don't think she will do something to promote compromises or peaceful or diplomatic solution.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has recently said, quote, "The Western alliance intends to keep fighting for Ukraine until it wins back all the territory Russia has seized since 2014. However, there seems to be an open wedge between the parliament and the Italian people. Latest polls show that more than half of Italians advocate for peace negotiations between Russia and Ukraine, and only a third are okay with a country sending more weapons to Kiev.
Peace talks must be started now. They have to find a solution to end this war. This situation is dangerously taking us toward a brink.
We are being run by governments of weaklings in the pocket of NATO, and the Meloni government is no different. Our constitution clearly says Italy rejects war.
It's not anymore a war between Russia and Ukraine. It's about all of us. We begin to feel exhausted.
The approval of the motion in the lower house on supplying weapons to Ukraine also included a provision which increases military spending to 2% of GDP by 2028, as required by NATO. The motion is currently under discussion at the upper house. The Senate will have the final say on the matter. Max Civili, Rome.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Domestic violence is abuse that happens in a personal relationship. Domestic violence affects men and women of any ethnic group, race or religion, rich or poor, teen, adult or elderly. But most of its victims are women. In fact, one out of four women will be a victim at some point. The abuser may use fear, bullying and threats to gain power and control over the other person. These signs of abuse may happen soon after the start of the relationship and might be hard to notice at first. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Affluent, educated, safe. This is Singapore's public face. But this seemingly ideal country, famously known as the Little Red Dot, has her dark secrets. The unemployment rate stands at less than 5%, and the crime rate is one of the lowest in the world. But other numbers tell a different side of her story. 1 in 10 women in Singapore has experienced physical violence or sexual abuse, and 6 in 10 have endured violence repeatedly. But only a fraction of these victims come forward to the authorities for help. This week on Aperture, we will take a walk into the world of abused spouses in Singapore and follow the journey of three abused women to learn of their trauma, hear of their heartbreak, and share their dreams. Stay with us.
When an educated society hears but does not listen.
He would beat me up in front of his mom, in front of my maids, in public.
When victims are shamed into silence.
I didn't want people to know that, you know, I was like one of the statistics, you know, oh, abused wife, and then, you know, the pity, and then, you know, the whispering, the gossiping and all that. I really didn't want any of that.
When home is no longer a safe haven, where do these women find the courage to be no longer victims? Singapore, a small island nation with big dreams. Where 1 in 4 have a university degree. 90% own a home. The unemployment rate stands at an underwhelming 2%, and over 100,000 millionaires call this home. But behind the numbers, there are secrets best kept hidden.
I thought he would be a good husband. During courtship days, he really took very good care of me. He really doted on me, was very affectionate, very loving. I would say that he went out of his way to accommodate my requests, you know. So there was really no warning signs, you know, that he would change so drastically after marriage.
At 20, Rachel found out she was pregnant.
I think it's more of society's pressure than, you know, because 16 years ago, it's not very acceptable, you know, to be a single mother. And also I wanted a complete family for my kid. So it was more of an obligation.
Just months into the marriage, the verbal abuse started.
From someone who's very loving to you, you know, who treated you like a queen, you know, put you on a pedestal, and then, you know, suddenly that someone actually tells you, know, that you are the reason why he lost his job, you know, because of certain superstition or, you know, your birthday clash, you know, that kind of thing, and you know, it's all your fault. And then how come you put on so much weight after pregnancy? I didn't sign up for that, you know, and I can't even bear to look at you now.
This was the start of Rachel's 8-year ordeal of living with an abusive husband. She was 5 months pregnant with her first child.
We were having an argument. I was defending my point of view. And then he just snapped and he just shoved me.
Abandoned, shocked, betrayed, Rachel struggled with all these emotions.
I think most importantly is that I really didn't want to accept the fact that, you know, he was like that, and, you know, that's the way it's going to be moving on. And given the fact that, you know, we are already married and we have a child on the way, you know, I felt very trapped.
Money and the lack of close family support also reduced her options.
Emotionally, was because my parents didn't like him. So it was a case of, like, you know, I told you so. Back then, the laws didn't allow divorcees to buy their own house, so housing would be an issue. Also, in terms of financially, I wonder if I would be able to support the child on my own.
Rachel hoped the baby would change him, make him softer, happier. But the stresses of first-time parenthood quickly dispelled her illusions.
Things got actually worse when the baby kept crying. You know, he would scream at me and ask me, you know, oh, what kind of mother are you? Don't even know how to take care of your own kid. I don't see other people's babies screaming or crying like that, you know.
His anger reached a boiling point after he lost his job and the family became reliant on Rachel's income.
He perceived it as some kind of attack on his manhood. And given the fact that I gradually earned more than him over the years, it didn't bode well for our relationship.
A few drinks, a perceived disobedience, and the cycle would start again.
He was hitting me, he was raining blows on me, and I fell over the wrong way. Yeah, I actually hit my back actually hit against the side of the coffee table, yeah, and I just fell over, yeah. So my back was thrown at a very unnatural angle.
Hours flowed into days, weeks into months, months into years. But all roads still led headfirst into a brick wall.
I really lost count. I've been in A&E for my slip disc. I thrown up my back, various kind of bleeding, head injuries. I had to go for CT scan, MRIs.
All this time, Rachel chose to hide her pain and lead a double life.
Sometimes I feel like such a fraud, you know. Obviously, at home, I'm going through all these things, you know, and I already feel very injured. Injured not only physically, you know, emotionally. Feel very betrayed, you know. Feel very angry. And you have to hide all that, you know, because during work, you know, I had to be very professional, okay? And I don't want to bring my personal life into my professional life, you know, and to maintain that kind of professional respect, you know, the kind of facade that I have to put up.
On average in Singapore, 3,000 spousal abuse cases are reported each year. But family violence specialists believe this represents just the tip of the iceberg.
We also know that less than 10% of women who have experienced abuse come forward to the formal helping agencies, whether it's the police or whether it's the family service centre. So what prevents these people from getting help?
One key reason why Rachel stayed with her husband for as long as she did was for her children, who never saw their father beating their mother.
While he wasn't a good husband, he was a good father. So I was very conflicted. While I had to take care of myself, I also have to consider the feelings of my daughter. You know, I didn't want her to have a broken family. I really tried to make things work. There was a lot of self-doubt. Am I too strong? Should I be more docile? Should I be more submissive? Should I be more gentle?
All her doubts were finally erased one night.
I was sleeping, you know, he just pulled me out of bed and, you know, he was hitting me. And my elder daughter actually came out of her room. She was very, very shocked when she saw what was going on. She was very brave. She tried to protect me, so she was trying to pull him off me. At that point, I think he was very infuriated, you know. So he didn't realise it was her, so he just flung her off. She was thrown against the wall. That was really the last straw for me, that she was being physically thrown off like that. It just made me snap in a way that I realised that, you know, it had to stop right there and then.
The very next day, Rachel and her two daughters moved out. Her husband immediately tried to apply for a personal protection order against her, saying that she had injured him during the fight.
The officer who processed the case, when he called me up to investigate the matter, you know, I actually showed him the reports, the medical reports, you know, and the different police reports I made over the years, you know, and I showed it to him. I mean, just look, and what do you think? So that case was actually thrown out.
She filed for divorce the very same week, but it took 2 years before the case was settled. Rachel gave up on alimony in exchange for full custody of their children.
I've always told them that whatever happened between me and their father, it's between the adults. And it's very difficult for me to say this, but I always told them, you know, that they shouldn't hate him. They are entitled to feel anger, of course, and to work on that anger, you know. But I don't want them to hate him.
The International Violence Against Women survey that we completed in 2010 was done because we felt that up to that point, as a country, as a nation, we had no idea as to the prevalence of violence against women nationwide. And we found that 9.2%, or 1 out of 10 women that we surveyed, reported they experienced physical violence and or sexual abuse from their partners.
The survey used a sample size of 2,000 women aged 18 to 60 years old and asked very specific questions. Have you been slapped, punched, and strangled? Has sex been forced upon you against your will? And out of those 1 in 10 women who answered yes, another number came to light.
More than half of them said it has happened more than once. 3 times, 6 times, you know. So we're not talking about people who, on the first instance of violence, you know, begin to go to the police or shout for help and all that.
When is domestic violence a public issue? Who has a right to intervene? Why do victims remain silent?
It's not a slap or two. I was really getting beaten up badly in public, in the house, and I still kept quiet and smiled.
Power, control, dominance. These are the driving forces behind domestic violence. Shame, fear, isolation. These are the shackles holding victims in place. Family, children, a happy ever after. This is what Mira hoped for when she married her first love.
We had really good chemistry. I mean, he spoke very, very well. He made me laugh.
In the first year of marriage, when Mira was 7 months pregnant, the violence kicked in.
He used vulgarities on me, calling me a and I answered him back. And that's when he kicked my head like it was a football and stepped on my head. I screamed for help. I tried to open the door as I got up, screaming for my mother-in-law to help. He pulled my hair back, continued to beat me up even more. And after that, he told me why he beat me up, made it my fault. And I had to go down and apologize to my mother-in-law and say it's my fault.
The day Mira's son was born, she saw a flicker of hope.
The day I gave birth, he was awesome. That's when I felt that amazing man I married. He was there throughout the time I was in labor and all. After that, things changed completely because that night itself, drank, came back, being in the hospital. Basically, I was abused terribly as I was practically bedridden in bed, vulgarities, everything. So it became a weekly affair, you could say, of getting abused physically, emotionally, mentally.
Mira's husband had a temper and he wasn't shy about showing it wherever and whenever his buttons were pushed.
He would beat me up in front of his mom, in front of my maids, in public. Imagine, he beat me up among the clubs in Serangoon Road, dragged me on the road and all. And when someone tried to come and help me and he told the guy, this is my wife, you don't touch her, you don't have any right to touch her. Nobody helped me. Everyone just watched the fun.
When Mira's husband lost his temper, it wasn't just a slap or a shove.
He's a very strong guy. He never beat me like it was a woman giving a slap. He beat me up like a guy. 2 fractures, a bleeding nose, multiple bruises to the head, multiple bruises to the thighs, to the back, an extremely swollen rib for a good 2 weeks. Name it, been there, done that. And yeah, the last one, permanent scar for life, a slash on the face.
Beyond the physical abuse, what cut us deeply were the relentless emotional attacks that shattered her self-esteem.
Emotionally, what he would do is this. He abused me in front of his mom, his maid, his friends. He called me a prostitute. He says I'm a lousy mother. I'm a lousy wife. I should be grateful that he married me, that, you know, I'm living with his family and all that, and food is there and all. I should feel grateful.
We've come across many cases where you have both emotional violence as well as physical violence. And what is really striking is that when a victim relates what she remembers of the incidents, it's very often it's the emotional violence, it's the words used that, you know, actually has the deepest scars.
Mira believes her family would have intervened strongly had they known what was going on, but she chose to hide the abuse from them.
I didn't want to involve my family because I didn't want my family to look down on him. I wanted my marriage to work. Nobody gets married thinking, okay, fine, I get married today, and when am I going to divorce? Nobody does that. Marriage is sacred. A man and woman gets married, they have children, they go to work, they bring up their kids, and you know, they see their kids through teen years and all that. That's life. And that's what I wanted. Why I stuck through is not just simply because of marriage. I really loved him.
Although her family did not know about the abuse initially, her husband's family did. But they chose to turn a blind eye.
My mother-in-law saw me get abused. She watched me get abused. He's got 3 other siblings. I did seek help, crying to his sisters, younger one and older one. Younger one was very much more empathetic towards me. But they felt that they couldn't do anything about it because he was beyond control. I was always told that it's, you know, it's in my hands to change him.
By the end of their first year of marriage, Mira had obtained a personal protection order, or PPO. If her husband is violent against her, he can be fined up to $2,000, jailed up to 6 months, or both. But the PPO does have its limitations. It's not a restraining order which would prevent the abusive spouse from coming near or having contact with the victim.
The perpetrator could follow the victim to work, could call the victim all the time, send her SMSs, you know, multiple SMSs to harass her, could sort of always be within sight of the victim but not actually physically touch her. So all of these things can be intimidating, very, very annoying, disruptive to the victim's life still. And in other countries, the court has the power to actually restrict and to prohibit the perpetrator from carrying out these acts. I think those kinds, the court should actually have wider powers to make such orders in Singapore as well.
Despite the PPO, the threats continued. 10 months later, Mira moved back to her parents' house for the third time. Her husband turned up at the company where she worked.
He came to my office and humiliated me. He was drunk in the morning, calling me the CBD in front of everyone, lunchtime.
A few days later, he broke into her mother's apartment at 6 in the morning.
He broke into my home with a knife and a brick. I had my siblings, my brother, my son and all there. He pinned me down as I had my son in my arms. He slashed me behind my ear, on my face. I was screaming. Everyone was awake in my home. It was chaos. My sister-in-law, my sister and all helped me. They took my son away. I ran out of the home. I thought he was going to come after me with a knife, but he didn't. All he did was say that he just wanted to disfigure me and leave.
Mira's husband was arrested and sentenced to more than 6 months in prison. He has just been released.
If he's going to try and come back, I would just do the simple thing. I'll call the police. I mean, I have a PPO. So I will call the police and all, and he knows that if he's going to try and come back, it's going to be even a tougher sentence this time. During my marriage, I was really afraid and I lived in fear. So at this point of time, I'm very confident. I don't need to feel afraid anymore.
Waiting, watching, standing still. More often than not, this is the norm, not the exception.
So I think Singaporeans make very good bystanders. I think that's something that is part of our conditioning. We are a society where we are peace-loving, law-abiding, and we generally let the authority take care of a problem. I think that this is a function of, one, Singapore being a fast-paced urban country where there people may not have as much time for each other. There may not be that much trust between strangers. And there is a certain attitude that we should each mind our own business.
How does the law define spousal violence? What happens to cases which don't meet the legal criteria? How do we help the most vulnerable victims?
Yes, we don't have anything. 身份一个好像空空啊，一个非公民这样。要是你离婚了，你回去哪里快乐？一个和孩子分开，看不到。5.2
million people live in Singapore today. Over 2 million of them are foreigners. Drawn here by dreams of wealth, the promise of work, and the hope of love. In recent years, approximately 40% of marriages in Singapore have been between a citizen and a foreigner.
One in three of the women that are presented with issues of spousal violence are actually foreign wives. And this was actually an increase from the previous years, where it was one in five of every woman that came forward to seek help.
Love, convenience, citizenship. There are many reasons why foreign women marry Singaporean men, but one common theme recurs in these relationships.
So generally what we hear from our foreign wives is that there's a sense of fear that they're often threatened by their husbands. At the end of the day, if they are going to report, for example, about the spousal violence incidents, they're going to be sent back to their home countries. And then they risk not able to see their children or maybe even lose custody of their children because of their citizenship or legal right to be in Singapore.
This has been Vu's story since she came to Singapore.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. Thank you for joining us in a new episode of For a Better Life, the House of Ideas, where we think more on different issues related to life. This is Asma. I'm a student of English literature, and it's been quite a while that I have the pleasure of being a member of this big family. As for today, we will have some interesting stuff to think about, and it has to do something with logic. In our religion, we have always been asked to think and find the reasons. In the Holy Book of Quran, the word thinking has been used many times. Allah Himself constantly in our Holy Book addresses His obedience to ponder and reflect on different issues. For sure, He has given us the faculty of thinking and logic for a reason. Otherwise, we would have been same as the animals, going with the instincts all alone. And you know how miserable that situation could be. Brain is the light from the inside that leads us into the truth. If we turn this light off, then we get stuck in different traps. Moreover, God blessed us with these gifts, and He would ask us about them. That is, we are responsible to make the best out of them. Because in the day of judgment, we wouldn't be able to claim that we didn't have a brain to think. It's just that we ignored it, and we did not give that light a chance to help us through. Regarding this issue, the Holy Book of Quran says, "And follow not that of which you have not the knowledge. Surely hearing and the sight and the heart of all these shall be questioned about." Well, it's pretty clear that human beings without their thinking faculty are nothing but animals with a tongue that prattles baselessly. Now, the problem is not going to end there, because ignorance comes with too much of consequences. We see many people around us who don't pay ahead for the instructions of their brain. That is, whatever they feel true, they go for it with no questions and with no more of observing or studying in the situation. But is it the best way to tread in the path of life that's got no chance for returning back? But before we get into this question, let's go for a short break. Then we'll be back. Thank you for listening. Stick around. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is For a Better Life, and I'm Asma. We were talking about logic, questioning every single thing. We are thinking about reasoning, the thing that has too much importance in our life, and it has been very much focused in our holy book, as well as the narrations of our religious heritage. We said we are responsible towards all our blessings, one of which is thinking faculty and the knowledge we gain through it. Without thinking, we might be worthless beings, and if we consider thinking as the eye of the body of our existence, then without it, we are definitely going in darkness and walking aimlessly in the shadows of ambiguity. We would be just like the blind people who are not aware of where they are going. The truth is, taking care of every single step we take according to our brain is something very difficult. I just wonder when I see people calling this process an easy process, and they feel like it's something that happens pretty much naturally. Well, the truth is, it needs a lot of practice, and it does not come just as if you're drinking water. It's not a piece of cake, of course. You will have to try for it, and you will have to go through too much of trial and error, and then you have to improve your reasoning and your logic. It is important. Why? Because we're living in a world in which there is media, there is propaganda, there are actually a lot of things that might happen to have an important role in our future. So if we're not going to think properly, if we don't take the true path to our future, then chances we might get lost, because as you know, we are not all aware of every single thing that happens around us. So we need to use our brain pretty much delicately, because there are some traps that even those people who are scholars might get into those traps. And it happens so much. It's nothing very easy or something that just happens to a small group of people to get entangled in some traps that are going to get us into dark future. And the destination that we have might be bright, but if we do not use that brain, if we do not use that insight that God has bestowed us with, then we're going to be lost. And as I just mentioned before, it is an important fact because in the Holy Book of Quran also, all the time that there is a warning, God tells us, don't you think, don't you use your brain. And we have too much of stories that there were a group of people, nations, families who had everything as the facility for growing, for development, for getting into the perfect destinations. But then all of a sudden, through a wrong action they made based on the error of their brain, then they could not get through, and then they fall into the traps of this world, and then everything is just lost. So as I just told you, since it's a friendly environment, I'm just telling you this as a member of this very great number of audience, I would say thinking is not an easy job. And trust me, we do it every day, but it's not as easy as it might sound. It is something that takes too much of knowledge. The thing that makes me wonder too much is the fact that people nowadays use their books as a sign of social distinction, but they did not make it as a tool, as an instrument that they could use to improve their insight. We have access to online books. We have access to different libraries. We don't have to go through them because everything is very much available, and just you go to net and everything is just there. But the problem is we don't go so deeply in between the lines of whatever we read, and we don't take them so serious. It has been something that's just like a trend. Like anything else that's going on trend and so viral, it shouldn't be like this. Actually, these books, whatever, whether it be a religious book that is related to our religious heritage, or a book that is related to self-growth and whatever that is related to ourselves, to our essence, to improving our psyche, is going to help us improve ourselves. It's going to help us improve our insight. And then in different situations, we could have a better way of making decisions, of understanding things, of not believing things blindly, of not imitating others blindly.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Just if I want to wrap it all up, I would say that thinking is an important thing. We have to read too much. We have to study too much. And even experiencing, living with other people, having interaction with different societies, with different people, with different friends, that are going to actually have some benefits for us in regarding, of course, teaching us things, helping us grow. We will improve our faculty of thinking. We will improve our logic, which is going to help us in our way toward salvation and toward a better life, of course. And it will help us not to get into the traps of this world because, you know, there is no guarantee for anyone. So we all are prone to getting lost. So it's pretty logical to use our brain to pay too much of attention to whatever we think, whatever we feed our brain to think about. And we should actually take all of these things into consideration whenever we are going to make decisions, whenever we're going to build our character, of course, because day by day we are just helping ourselves grow. And this process is not going to end anywhere. Every day is a new chance for us to turn it all around. If we have a wrong thought, we can change it. And it's not a gospel truth. Always you can try to be your better you. And that's it. Thank you for listening. Until another session, I bid you farewell. May Allah protect you and shower you with His blessings. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, He knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, He knows.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.